we are in the middle of examining 1 Kings chapter 6 concerning the building of the first temple. Now, this chapter and the next one are just full of details, especially about the interior of the temple, and certainly we're going to look at that. Now, perhaps I should have titled this lesson, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Solomon's Temple Was Afraid to Ask. That's just a little long. However, we're not going to spend an inordinate amount of time with that, first, because it can become a little bit tedious, second, because some of the wonderful artists' conceptions of what the items looked like can kind of cut to the chase and help us visualize the object, but also because at times the words describing a building or an object are so cryptic that there are numerous possibilities of just what those words were ever meant to convey to us. So we're going to approach this by concentrating more upon what some of those Hebrew terms that define the various objects actually mean, as opposed to the typical English translations of them. And we're going to deal with the location of the temple in relation to the structures as they exist on the Temple Mount today. Now, there's a controversial subject for you. Now, we're going to talk about Solomon's palace. And then next week, we'll look at the realities of what happened to Solomon's temple over the decades and over the centuries, and how it more or less chronicles the activities of the various kings of Israel and Judah up to the time of the destruction of it by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, in the end, we're going to see that it is the context of the temple that is more important than the temple itself. And the context of the temple is that while God indeed ordained a place to be divinely designated for him to dwell among his people, that clearly he ordained a basic design of it that somehow mimics and illustrates heavenly and spiritual principles, and that we need to understand that to dwell with his people does not mean he lives in that earthly place. Rather, he lives in heaven. And even more, the temple was never built for God's benefit. It was built for mankind's benefit, a lot like the Sabbath, Shabbat. And what's so interesting is, God doesn't ask for his people to build some opulent edifice for him. Matter of fact, he made it very clear to David that he was still perfectly satisfied with a tent to meet in. Open your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 340. 2 Samuel chapter 7. We're just going to read the first seven verses of this. After the king had been living in his palace a while, and Adonai had given him rest from all of his surrounding enemies, the king said to Nathan, the prophet, "Here, I'm living in a cedar wood palace, but the ark of God's kept in a tent." Nathan said to the king, "Go, do everything that's in your heart, for Adonai is with you." But that same night, the word of Adonai came to Nathan, "You go and tell my servant David that this is what Adonai says. You are going to build me a house to live in? Since the day I brought the people of Israel out of Egypt until today, I never lived in a house. Rather, I traveled in a tent and a tabernacle. Everywhere I traveled, with all the people of Israel, did I ever speak a word to any of the tribes of Israel, whom I ordered to shepherd my people Israel, asking, 'Why haven't you built me a cedar wood house?'" This is why we ended last week by focusing on the matter of the Lord interrupting the temple building process and reestablishing the proper context of the temple with Solomon. Solomon was so busily concentrating on building this wonderful and expensive house for God, when unexpectedly, we find in 1 Kings 6, 11 through 13, God's oracle comes to Shlomo that if he'll follow the Lord's regulations and obey the Torah commandments, then the Lord will bring about the promise that was made to David. And that promise was that Yehovah would be Israel's God, that they would be his people, and that David's dynasty would rule forever. Now, what a great teaching moment that was, but tragically, Solomon missed it. However, I don't want to miss it. The point being made was that while building a place of worship and meeting and sacrifice was needed for fellowship between God and his people, it came in a distant second to Solomon's trust in and obedience to God. Therefore, Solomon should not think that the high degree of expense and perfection of the temple that he has under construction has anything to do with God's acceptance of the people of Israel, or whether his blessings for his people and for the king are somehow tied to that. That's pagan thinking. It's not for his set-apart people. Now, since time immemorial, it has been that mankind, I think in kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the influence of our evil inclinations, thinks that building some fabulous structures in the name of our God is for the sake of pleasing that God. Yehovah makes it clear that while false gods seem to demand it, he doesn't. Besides, there's nothing on earth that mankind could ever conjure up in our minds and make it with our hands that would be grand enough to properly house such a holy God anyway. So the most magnificent temple, as far as God's concerned, isn't any better than a simple tent. Solomon is not making something that's going to please the Lord any better than did the original wilderness tabernacle that the Lord said he wanted built. This principle is of the greatest importance for Christ's ecclesia, his church, to grasp. See, we have always been in the habit of diverting our eyes from the Lord and onto building projects. We create amazing architectural works, ornate, decked out in the best and the most expensive building materials, and then we claim that our whole intent is to honor God with all of this. We go so far as to regularly confer holiness upon these structures if they're grand enough, and we look upon them with reverent awe. In fact, the subconscious human thought seems to be that if we don't build a building beautifully enough, maybe we're disappointing the Lord. Or the building might even wind up with a lesser degree of holiness than that one down the street that's so much bigger and better and prettier. The truth is, God's not honored one whit by these structures. It's the builders who are honored, and this honor is conferred upon them by other men. It's the donors who supplied the funds that received the praise, the recognition from other men. It's the pastor, the priest who presides over it all, that's honored, held up high by other men. Although we would generally deny it, I think, as worshipers of the God of Israel, we may even harbor this subconscious expectation that our participation in constructing or belonging to such a spectacular spectacular meeting place of worship elevates us in God's eyes. Or that maybe our prayers are a little bit better heard than someplace else. The reality is that by all scriptural standards, God's not seeking any such thing, but humans tend to. Rather, he warns against that kind of mindset, because while there is nothing inherently wrong or sinful with building a beautiful church, a wonderful synagogue, it is a nearly irresistible temptation to pride and to haughtiness and to relying on the works of our hands for our righteousness. A building can easily become a substitute for a right relationship of love and trust and obedience to God. That said, a safe place, comfortable, for worship, for meeting, suitable for the purpose of, is always reasonable and needed. But it's also always for our benefit. It's not for God's, and we shouldn't delude ourselves otherwise. Generally speaking, the more modest and practical that a meeting place is, the better, I think, that it reflects the true understanding and embracing of God's principles. Now, obviously, there's variables. We're not expected to operate out of a substandard or overcrowded facility if we don't have to, and the nature of the facility is going to necessarily reflect our culture. Nonetheless, the church and the synagogue should strive to be modest, pragmatic in our congregational requirements when it comes to our own personal comforts, and that so we can be about the Lord's work of ministering to others in whatever way he's assigned us. Okay, with that, let's reread part of chapter 6 to get our bearings this evening. Open up your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 6. 1 Kings chapter 6. We're going to start reading at verse 19. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, that'll be on page 374. 374. 1 Kings chapter 6, starting at verse 19. Yep, 19. In the inner court, or rather, the inner part of the house, he set up the sanctuary so that the ark for the covenant of Adonai could be placed there. This sanctuary was 35 feet long, wide, and high, and it was overlaid with pure gold. In front of it, he set an altar, which he covered with cedar. Shlomo overlaid the interior of the house with pure gold, and he had chains of gold placed before the sanctuary, which itself he overlaid with gold. The entire house he overlaid with gold until it was completely covered with it. He also overlaid with gold the entire altar that belonged to the sanctuary. Inside the sanctuary, he made two keruvim, cherubim, of olive wood, each 17 and a half feet in length, rather high. And each of the two wings of one of the cherubim was 8 3/4 feet long, so that the distance from the end of one wing to the end of the other was 17 and a half feet. And likewise, the wingspread of the other cherub was 17 and a half feet. Both keruvim were identical in shape and size. And the height of the one cherub was 17 and a half feet, likewise that of the other. He set the cherubim in the inner house. The wings of the cherubim were stretched out so that the wing of one touched the wall. The wing of the other cherub touched the other wall. Their wings touched each other in the middle of the house. He overlaid the keruvim with gold. And all around the walls of the house, both inside the sanctuary and outside of it, he carved figures of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. He overlaid the floor of the house with gold, both inside the sanctuary and outside of it. For the entrance to the sanctuary, he made doors of olive wood set within a five-sided door frame. On the two olive wood doors, he carved figures of keruvim, palm trees, and open flowers. He overlaid the doors with gold, forcing the gold into the shapes of the keruvim and palm trees as well. For the entrance to the temple, he also made doorposts of olive wood, set within a rectangular door frame, and two doors of cypress wood. The two leaves of the one door were folding, as were the two leaves of the other. On them he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, overlaying them with gold fitted to the carved work. He built the inner court with three rows of cut stone and a row of cedar beams. Now the foundation of the house of Adonai was laid in the fourth year in the month of Ziv, in the 11th year in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month. All parts of the house were completed exactly as designed. Thus, he was 7 years building it. In verse 19, the complete Jewish Bible says that the inner part of the house was set up to accommodate the Ark of the Covenant. Other Bibles usually say the oracle in the midst or some such thing. What they're struggling with is the Hebrew word debir, which is related to the root Hebrew word debar. And the root word means word or speech. So oracle is a good translation. But what we are seeing here is that debir, not debar, debir has become a technical term for the Holy of Holies in these passages. And the Holy of Holies was constructed as a perfect cube, 20 by 20 by 20 cubits. Or in feet, about 35 feet long, 35 feet wide, 35 feet high. A lot of gold was used inside of this room to adorn it. Now the mention of a cedar wood altar is referring to the altar of incense that would not be inside the Holy of Holies, but rather it would be located inside the front room of the temple, the holy place, just in front of the entry before you go into the Holy of Holies. In verse 23, we see the sculpting of two creatures called Karuvim in Hebrew, or cherubim in English. Now, I want to remind you, cherubim, Karuvim, are not angels. There are several kinds of mysterious spiritual beings listed in the scriptures, and angels are one of them. Cherubim are another, and there's others. This is not the first use of these sculptures. In the instructions for the wilderness tabernacle and in its furnishings, the lid, the kapporet, or mercy seat for the Ark of the Covenant, had two cherubim that were molded into it. But Solomon wanted to go one better. So he ordered these two gigantic Karuvim, cherubim, to be constructed and placed into the Debir, the Holy of Holies. Now it's interesting, I think it's kind of an ominous sign, that it is the cherubim that became the dominant feature of that room, rather than the Holy Ark of the Covenant. That ark was what was originally designed to be the prominent feature of the Holy of Holies. Solomon made it the cherubim. It is really easy for us to establish something great in our lives that is supposedly for God, but it often comes close to replacing God. And at the least, it relegates him to second place. And I'm going to tell you, that can be anything that we hold too high. Anything. From our jobs, to our homes, to a hobby, to our family, and to our children. Now briefly, each cherub had a total wingspan of 10 cubits from end to end, which would have been, how wide was the Holy of Holies? 20. So it was one half the width, each cherubim, their wingspan, one half the width of the Holy of Holies. And they were placed in such a way that their wingtips touched. So the left wing of one cherub touched the right wing of the other, and they each, the outer wings, each touched the room's walls. Verse 29 now reverts from speaking only of the Debir, the Holy of Holies, and tells us that throughout the Beit, the house, the entire temple, there was also a liberal use of carvings of Karuvim, cherubs. in the wood paneling. Verse 31 now tells us that with the entrance into what the complete Jewish Bible calls the sanctuary, there was a door. Other Bibles call this the shrine or even the oracle. And the original Hebrew comes to our rescue as we try to figure out what this is. Because the Hebrew word is debir, and we know that this is referring to the door into the Holy of Holies. So this passage is talking about the entranceway from the holy place into the Holy of Holies. Now, in the wilderness tent, this entrance was covered with a veil, Hebrew, a parochet. But here in Solomon's temple, there is instead an elaborate wooden door frame with olive wood doors mounted in that frame. Cherubim, palm trees have been carved into these massive doors. And they're also carved all over the interior now of the temple. Verse 33 then speaks of the entrance into the temple building, which is called in Hebrew Hekal, which leads directly now into the front chamber. First chamber you encounter, the holy place. And unlike the doors between the holy place and the Holy of Holies, these were interior doors that were all made out of olive wood, the main temple entry door was made out of fir or cedar. And on these doors were also carved cherubim and palm trees, obviously very popular things. And finally, this chapter finishes with describing a courtyard that was built just outside of the temple entrance called the inner courtyard. Now, the Mishnah says that actually there were two courtyards, the courtyard of the Kohanim, courtyard of the priests, and the courtyard of Israel, that just meaning the common people. And likely this is what is being referred to here in 1 Kings chapter 6. The Mishnah says that there was yet another courtyard called the courtyard of the women. But it was a little bit further away from the temple entrance than the other two courtyards, so that is why this first courtyard is typically dubbed the inner courtyard. The last two verses embellishes the very first verse of this chapter, because here we're told that it was the foundation of the temple that was laid in the month of Ziv in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, and that in the 11th year of Solomon's reign, in the month of Bul, which corresponds to today what's more known as Heshvan, which is an October-November time frame, that's when the temple was completed. So that means it was completed shortly after the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. It also means that it took 7 years and 6 months from the laying of the temple foundation to completion. Now notice that the final words of this chapter are, says it took 7 years to build this temple. See, this is an example of using round numbers, especially when the number is such a symbolic number, like seven. These numbers are rarely meant to be rigid absolutes, and we have to be careful not to consider them that way. Let's move on to 1 Kings chapter 7. 1 Kings chapter 7. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, page 375. And we're going to read verses 1 through 26 this evening. Long chapter. 1 Kings chapter 7. Shlomo, Solomon, built a palace for himself, taking 13 years to finish it. For he built the house of the Lebanon forest, 175 feet long, 87 and a half feet wide, and 52 and a half feet high, on four rows of cedar posts with cedar beams on the posts. It had a roof made of cedar and supported by beams lying on 45 posts, 15 in a row. There were three rows of window openings, placed so that the windows on facing walls were opposite each other at all three levels. All the doors and doorways were rectangular and opposite each other at all three levels. He made the columned hall 87.5 feet long and 52.5 feet wide, with a columned corniced porch in front of it. He made the hall of the throne his place for dispensing justice, that is, the hall of judgment. It was covered with cedar wood from floor to ceiling. He is his own living quarters in the other courtyard, set back from the hall, were similarly designed. He also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom Shlomo had taken as his wife. Now, all of these buildings were made of expensive stone blocks, cut to measure and finished by saws on the inner surfaces as well as on the outer ones. These stones were used from the foundation to the eaves and outward from the buildings all the way to the great courtyard. The foundation was of expensive stone blocks, very large ones, stones 14 to 18 feet long. Above these were costly stones cut to measure in cedar wood. The surrounding great courtyard had three rows of cut stone and a row of cedar beams, like the inner courtyard of the house of Adonai and the courtyard by the hall of the house. King Shlomo sent for Hiram and brought him from Tzor. He was the son of a widow from the tribe of Naphtali, but his father was from Tzor, a bronze worker filled with wisdom, understanding, and skill for all kinds of bronze craftsmanship. He came to King Solomon, and he did all of his bronze work. He made the two bronze columns, each one 31.5 feet high and 21 feet in circumference. He made two capitals of melted bronze to set on the tops of the columns. Each capital was 8.75 feet high. He also made checkerwork nets and chained wreaths, 7 for the top of each capital. And when he made the columns, he made two rows of pomegranates to put at the top of each column around the netting covering its capital. The capitals on the columns in the hall had shapes like lilies, and they were 7 feet high. As for the capitals on the two columns, there were 200 pomegranates in rows around each capital near the molding by the netting. He erected the columns in the hall of the temple. On erecting the right column, he gave it the name Yakin, and on erecting the left column, he named it Boaz. And on the tops of the columns were shapes like lilies. Thus the work of the columns was finished. He made the cast metal C circular, 17.5 feet from rim to rim, 8.75 feet high, 52.5 feet in circumference. And under its rim, 300 gourds encircled it in two rows. They were cast when the sea was cast, and it rested on 12 oxen, 3 looking north, 3 looking west, 3 looking south, and 3 looking east, all with their hindquarters towards the center. The sea was set on top of them. It was a handbreadth thick. Its rim was made like the rim of a cup, like the flower of a lily, and its capacity was 11,000 gallons. This chapter is about building Solomon's palace, or better, a palace complex, because it consisted of multiple buildings. Now, it's interesting that the Book of Chronicles omits recording the construction of Solomon's palace. It was very likely near the temple, just to the south of it, perhaps in the northernmost end of an area that today is called the Ophel. The Ophel is an area uphill. It's just outside the original walls of the city of David that lay between the city of David and the Temple Mount. So it's in between the two. Now, there are marvelously preserved ruins of this ancient area that you can stroll through to this day. Lots of interesting findings keep being made day by day. They've even found a tunnel that went all the way down to the real Pool of Siloam that goes under the hill and takes you all the way up to the Temple Mount, and you can walk most of those stairs today. And those going on the tour that can make it, You're going to get that opportunity. Well, apparently, Solomon's father's palace just wasn't sufficient for Solomon's growing family, his harem, and the number of the dignitaries that he was now entertaining. And immediately we're told it took him 13 years to complete his palace. This is intended to tell us that after the temple construction time of 7 years, Solomon's palace took an additional 13 years. So it wasn't until 20 years passed, about halfway through his reign, that Shlomo's temple and palace were completed. That doesn't mean that he had to wait until the completion of the entire complex before residing in it. No doubt he had moved in much earlier than when it was completed in its entirety. And all the palace complex consisted of four structures. The first of which is described in verse 2, and it's named the House of the Forest of Lebanon. Now, there's been a lot of controversy about this place, because some scholars claim that it means that this was a summer house that Shlomo literally built up north in Lebanon. But we can look for some context in other Bible passages and know that's not the case at all. In fact, this section of Solomon's palace became so well known that at times it was just called Lebanon for short. One place in other scriptures where the mention of Lebanon as part of his palace complex, not the country Lebanon, it's just the name for this one building in it. It occurs in Isaiah 10. In Isaiah 10:34, it says, "He will hack down the forest underbrush with an axe, and the Lebanon in its splendor falls." Without doubt, taken out of context, this sure doesn't sound like Solomon's palace, but rather like Lebanon proper. So I want us to read a few verses before this one in Isaiah. It's just a very good example of why we have to look very closely in our Bibles to understand what's really going on. So turn to Isaiah chapter 10. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's going to be on page 453. Isaiah chapter 10. 453, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, we're going to read from verses 23 through 34. Adonai Elohim Zevaot will bring about this decreed destruction throughout all the land. Therefore, Adonai Elohim Zevaot says, "My people living in Zion, don't be afraid of Asher. Even when he strikes you with a stick and raises his staff against you, the way it was in Egypt. For in but a little while, my fury will end and my anger will have destroyed them. Adonai Zevaot will wield a whip against them as he did when striking Midian at the rock of Orev. As his staff was over the sea, he will raise it the way it was in Egypt. And on that day, his burden will fall from your shoulders and his yoke from your neck. The yoke will be destroyed by your prosperity. He has come to Ayat, passed through Migron. He has stored his equipment in Michmash. They have crossed the pass, then lodged at Geba. Ramah is shaking. Gevat Shaul has fled. Cry, shriek, Bat Gelim. Listen, Laish, poor Anatot. Madmenah is in the fight. The people of Gevim take cover. This very day he will stop at Nob, and he will shake his fist at the mountain of the daughter of Zion, at the hill of Jerusalem, at the hill, at daughter of Zion, at the hill of Jerusalem. See how Adonai Zevaot lops off the branches with terrible violence. The ones standing highest are chopped down, the lofty are laid low. He will hack down the forest underbrush with an axe, and the Lebanon in its splendor falls." We are specifically told here, the reason we went through all this, we are specifically told that the action taking place is happening in the land of Zion. And then begins a listing of many of its known cities, all, of course, in the promised land. It is speaking about the loftiest ones being laid low, that is, the rich, the leaders, the aristocrats, the most important people. Then it speaks of the Lebanon being felled. This, of course, is speaking metaphorically of Solomon's palace, which was renowned the world over and was a great point of national pride for Israel. And the palace structure called Lebanon for short, or as we find it in 1 Kings chapter 7, the Forest of Lebanon, was just an amazing place. And the reason it was called the Forest of Lebanon is because of how it looked, how it was constructed. It was this maze of cedar wood beams and posts. And since the cedar came from Lebanon, no doubt its name was both a euphemism and a kind of honorary name that would commemorate Lebanon's contribution to the temple and to Solomon's palace. It was huge. It was 100 cubits long, 50 wide, and 30 high. It was considerably bigger than the temple. In feet, it would have been about 175 feet by 88 feet, or about 15,000 square feet in size, as compared to the temple's 3,700 square feet. One can understand why no remnant of this structure has ever been found. It was made totally out of wood. And that in itself is just remarkable. Unbelievably expensive, which is why it was such a wonder to behold, so well remembered. Stone was the usual building material within the Promised Land. It was plentiful and it was long-lasting. Wood deteriorated, and the Promised Land only had smaller trees, most of which weren't suitable to be used for load-bearing, and they weren't big enough to make substantial beams or planks out of them. That use of a tiny amount of wood in a structure was only for the wealthy. To build an enormous building entirely from wood, well, that was just unheard of. In verse 6, another building is described, called simply the Hall or the Pillar Hall. It seems to have been a kind of an antechamber that served as an entrance to the building complex, the whole palace building complex, and it ran along the front of the Lebanon, so-called Lebanon section. In verse 7 is the third wing of the palace complex that is called the Hall of the Throne, also known as the Judgment Hall. This is where Solomon's throne was located and where the Sanhedrin likely met, if the traditions about that are accurate. So it was where justice was dispensed. The walls of this hall, we're told, were covered with cedar wood paneling, which means that it was made of stone construction. Verse 8 documents the fourth and final wing. This was Solomon's personal residence, and part of it was built for the Pharaoh's daughter, who was Solomon's most prized wife. Men and women inhabited separate quarters in general in that era, and especially so for aristocracy, because they often had several wives and concubines. Better not to mix them all up, don't you think? And ever since chapter 3, we've been hearing about Solomon's wife, Pharaoh's daughter, and of all the connections that Shlomo had with Egypt. This was no doubt a great political and economic coup for Solomon. But it was also a disaster waiting to happen, because the Lord had instructed in his Torah that Israel was not to reestablish ties with Egypt after their exodus, ever. Ever. Solomon had done so in spades. And the Pharaoh's daughter, well, she was the linchpin. She was the symbol of their alliance. So we read of the great lengths that King Solomon went to in order to honor and to accommodate her. There is no mention of her, interestingly, being seen as the official queen of Israel, so to speak, but she couldn't have been very far short of that status. Now, verse 9 explains that all of these buildings were made out of expensive stone blocks. Here's another case where the word all, kol, in Hebrew, is not an absolute. It's not meant to be precise. It's just a generality, because this certainly doesn't include the all-wood house of the Forest of Lebanon. Even so, stone blocks would have been employed with that building, at least for a foundation, of course. But the idea is that the stone blocks were mammoth in size, as much as 18 feet long, meaning they would have weighed perhaps 20 tons or more apiece. And the quarried stones above them, meaning the ones that were above the ground, and so they were visible, were highly finished and precisely cut, so they were beautiful. That's what made them expensive. The idea that these were some kind of super expensive stones, stone material like marble, or that they were gemstones or even semi-precious gemstones, isn't the context of this. No doubt, this was the typical limestone found in abundance in Israel. It was usual that foundation stones were essentially boulders that had just been minimally altered, since they were going to be underneath the building and hidden from view, and that the stones used above the ground would fit well enough that and were filled usually with copious amounts of mortar. That wasn't the case for Solomon's palace. All the stones were expertly hewn, and they had a snug fit and a very pleasing look as a result. Verse 13 now shifts the scene back to the temple, the work on the temple. Now remember, this book that we're reading, 1 Kings, isn't a daily journal. It's just a record of details of the building of the temple and the palace. And a fellow named Hiram, we're told, is sent from the country of Zor. This isn't King Hiram, but rather he is a man, interestingly, of Israelite heritage. He was a skilled artisan that was brought in to direct the crafting of the most visible and the most ornate of the parts of the temple, and especially of things that involve metal casting and bronze. Rashi explains that Hiram's father was from the tribe of Naphtali, his mother was from the tribe of Dan. It's only that he was living in the country of Zor and essentially had become a citizen of that nation. One cannot help but notice a striking parallel between the building of Solomon's temple and the wilderness tabernacle. King Shlomo was from the tribe of Judah, and he worked together with Hiram, who had roots in the tribe of Dan. In the wilderness, the chief builder of the temple was not Moses, but rather a fellow named Bezalel from the tribe of Judah and Aholiab from the tribe of Dan. Exodus 36:1. Bezalel and Aholiab, along with all the craftsmen whom Adonai has endowed with wisdom and skill necessary to carry out the work needed for the sanctuary, are to do exactly according to everything Adonai has ordered. So in verse 14, it describes Hiram, this skilled metal artisan, in exactly the same way as we just read from the book of Exodus, a bronze worker filled with wisdom, understanding, and skill for all kinds of bronze craftsmanship. The idea was to make the parallel between these two. And perhaps his biggest project is going to be these two pillars that will grace the front entrance to the temple. Verse 15 explains that he's going to cast in bronze two fabulous pillars, each 18 cubits high and 12 cubits in circumference. That's about 32 feet high, 21 feet around. That means the diameter of each pillar would have been about 7 feet. And on top of each of these pillars sat a decorative capital that was 5 cubits tall, not quite 9 feet. However, in 2 Kings 25, the height of the capital is given as 3 cubits. It's hard to know if one or the other of these numbers is an error, or just a different way to measure the capital's height. I don't know. Rashi says that an ancient Midrashic work explains that the total height of the capitals indeed was 5 cubits, but since the pillars were essentially hollow bronze tubes, 2 cubits of each capital stuck down inside of the hollow pillar for stability, leaving the upper 3 cubits of the capital, the decorative portion, visible. That's entirely possible, but there's no way to prove that. Anyway, the capitals were very ornate. They were shaped like opening flowers. They're cast with the images of pomegranates embedded in them. Exactly where they stood is a little bit questionable, but generally it seems that they were at the porch entry into the temple. The columns were given names. The one on the right was called Yakin, the one on the left, Boaz. Yakin means be established. Boaz means strength is within. Next is the crafting of the bronze or the molten sea. Now, this is essentially a giant water tank that equates to the laver, the water laver that was used with the wilderness tabernacle. And from this water tank, the priests could wash their hands, wash their feet before performing the ritual animal sacrifices. Now, some Christian scholars, Gentiles, of course, taught that this sea was used for bathing. Yipes. And wonderful paintings were fashioned to show the priest taking baths inside this. Naturally, that's pretty far off the mark. This vessel was called the sea, the mare, because of its enormity. This was a copper or bronze kettle, essentially, made by sand casting, just like the two pillars were, probably accomplished in the desert area of Timnah, known for its copper mines, or maybe Sukkot, known for its clay that is good for the molding process. Anyway, the molten sea was 10 cubits in diameter, 10 cubits across, 18 feet, and 5 cubits, almost 9 feet high. This giant pot of water rested on a dozen bronze oxen with 4 groups of 3, and each group was said to point in a specific compass direction. So they were displayed, much like during the Exodus, when the 12 tribes marched and encamped together in 4 groups of 3, each group occupying a compass direction. The oxen all faced outward, and the sea then rested on their backs and their hindquarters. Now, the weight of this must have been enormous, as the cast metal pot was a full hand breadth, in other words, about 4 inches thick. It contained almost 12,000 gallons of water, about as much as a small to medium-sized home swimming pool. It is thought that the water was not put into it from buckets, but means literally from a pipe. Plumbing was not unknown in this era. In fact, I have personally witnessed in Israel the discovery made less than 24 hours earlier, just happened to walk upon it, of a section of baked clay pipe down by the Pool of Siloam at the bottom of the hill of the city of David. It was probably about 5 inches in diameter and definitely dated. The digger and the archaeologist was there at that moment of discovery, and told me it was definitely from David's era, or even earlier, possibly. And it was perfectly intact. It was an amazing sight. Water used for this vessel was for ritual purposes. That means it had to be a type that the scriptures call Mayim Chaim, living water. This was water that comes from a moving source, like a river. It couldn't come from a well. It can't come from a pond. However, an artesian spring where water comes up from the ground under pressure is considered Maim Chaim. And we know that even today, artesian springs operate under the Temple Mount. In fact, they're having big problems right now with water pressure bulging, particularly the southern wall of the Temple Mount outward, to where there's a lot of people getting really worried that that whole side is about to collapse. Wouldn't that be a sight? Now, ancient Hebrew documents claim that there were holes in the bottoms of the feet of the cast oxen that allowed for pipes to be inserted. These were connected to these artesian springs, and this is what supplied the molten sea with these enormous quantities of water that they used every day. I think we'll stop here. And next week we're going to examine other of the objects used inside and outside of the temple walls. And we're also going to look at the history of Solomon's temple and tell its destruction.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.